Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways. Achtung, Achtung. Welcome to We Have Ways of Making You Talk with me, Al Murray, and James Holland. And James, who are we talking to today? And this is going to be really interesting, I think.
I think it will be too.
Go on.
Well, we're talking to Bastiaan Willem, and he is a young historian, I think it's good to say. He's also
considerably younger
than us.
Fresher faced than either of us old sods, yeah.
He's been a research fellow in modern European history at the University College London and is now at the LMU in Munich. And he is an expert on the Wehrmacht at the end of the war in the East. So we've dragged him on today to talk about particularly about Königsberg or Kaliningrad, as it now is, East Prussia and, the Wehrmacht fighting on German soil in 1944-45. And obviously a bloody grim tale, if ever there was one.
Welcome, Bastiaan.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I really, really appreciate it. Obviously, a big fan of James Holland, and my partner was actually more smitten with Al here.
I'll take that.
Yeah, I'll take that too, actually. You know, it's fine. Yeah. It's not all about looks. Words count too. Yeah.
Now, Bastiaan, you're I mean, I think we should say this. You're Dutch.
Yes, I am.
A simple question. How have you ended up with this as your line of study?
Yeah, I get this question very, very often. And here's the thing. I have no family relations whatsoever dating back to East Prussia, nor actually to Germany, for that matter. My family is really as Dutch as they come, and for generations we haven't moved basically one inch, so no, there's absolutely nothing that ties me to East Prussia. So what it really was, and I think this is recognizable for a lot of people, is as a very young kid I was interested in the Second World War, and you read about the Ardennes Offensive, you read about Arnhem, you read about Normandy, and there's ample books, so many books are available on these topics. What I found interesting was actually the Eastern Front, and I found it all seems to be very standard about what is written on it, and it's always this mass of Soviet troops invading, and I found this wildly, wildly fascinating. Obviously, the books that you read when you're a kid, this is very much sort of like this Cold War narrative of sort of like this the Soviets as this menacing group, or this Moloch almost, if you will, like this steamroller.
Yeah,
I found that very interesting. I knew I didn't understand it. At the same time, when I talked with my grandparents about this, my grandmother's brother was sent to Germany. So as a Dutch guy, he volunteered to go to Germany. It was his good friend who was forced to go to Germany as a forced laborer. But his friend had a kid, and so he asked, "Can I go in his stead?" And they said yes.
Wow.
He never came back from the war. He died somewhere in Germany, and my grandmother basically never forgave the Germans. The Germans were always the bad guys, right?
Yeah.
So, I found that very interesting, because to me, the idea that your neighbors, like being Dutch, right? So like they're your neighbors, like you have this group of people that you're supposed to find sort of like intrinsically evil. Right. And I found that very interesting. So you have this, to me, it was impossible to think all Germans are evil. And at the same time, there is this idea, but it cannot be what is the situation with the like with the Soviets, with the Russians? I also didn't understand that. So that basically drove me to the Eastern Front, also because like as a young kid that, you know, at the age of 15, you think you already read everything that there is to read about Arnhem and about Normandy, you know. Yeah. Like you read five books and you think, you know, I know this all, right? And so that was me done on the Western Front, so to speak. And so actually I moved pretty quickly. I moved to the Eastern Front with my interests. And so combining the Eastern Front with this idea of Germans and Germany, you end up in Eastern Germany.
Yeah.
And then there are a few cities that come to mind. Breslau is a city that is very often talked about. And Königsberg is another city. Now, during my undergraduate, I learned, okay, there is actually already quite some research into Breslau, especially from a military perspective. There were some good works out there. But for Königsberg, I found there's only a few scattered memoirs that are mostly very self-serving and completely unobjective and outdated, obviously. And I thought, you know, this is what I would like to know more about. And yeah, and here we all are.
Well, I completely understand why you're interested in that. I've always been slightly interested in Königsberg, and not least because it's this sort of jewel, isn't it, in the Baltic? It's an ancient city. It's a pretty beautiful city, and it just gets totally destroyed in the war, doesn't it? And you know, everything that it stood for centuries is just completely wiped, and it sort of and it sort of gets reborn with a different name, and it's almost like it's been raised and leveled and started again. I mean, it's the most extraordinary thing.
It has a 700-year-old history, like a proud, let's say, German Teutonic history. Yeah. that goes back very, very long. Just a very proud, a traditional society. I'd say more traditional than the rest of the rest of Germany. It is most definitely it's a German people living there, but
historically in a sort of colonial style, right?
It is Germany's easternmost outpost, absolutely. So like they come with the sword, so to speak. They say back in the Teutonic days, and then the plow follows. That is sort of their narrative, and obviously the Nazis they hold on to that narrative. They absolutely use that. They see East Prussia as sort of as an idea of how you can bring German, like the German sphere of influence, how you can export that, if you will. So if you look at East Prussia's Gauleiter, so East Prussia's Nazi leader, it's a guy called Erich Koch, and he is infamous basically throughout Eastern Europe. He becomes the ruler of Ukraine, and to him agriculture and agriculture autonomy, that is basically the be all and end all for him. And yeah, so you get into this situation where you have East Prussian as this traditional province with this agricultural foundation to it, and that is how East Prussians style themselves. Now, obviously, this all comes to a crashing halt in August 1944. You have the Royal Air Force comes in twice in a week, in the last week of August. And I want to stress, because I think a lot of people have struggled locating where this is on the map of Europe. This is so far into what we consider to be Eastern Europe. This is, you have to go beyond Poland. This is how far Germany reached. So back in the day. So if you want to have a parallel, how far the Royal Air Force went those nights. This is an 11-hour round trip.
Yeah.
It is as if the Russians were to bomb Paris while the Allies were in Normandy. Yeah. That is how far this is eastwards. Yeah. So it is so far. So basically, one of the first attempts of really using phosphor in a way like similar to Hamburg, for example, in 1943. And then a year later, the city is besieged by four full armies, and then basically is captured. So you first have two major Royal Air Force bombardments, and then four Soviet armies basically plow through that city with a staggering 2,500 planes of the Red Air Force, which is a third of the entire Red Army's Air Force at that point, contributing in these efforts. So at the end of the war, very little is left of Königsberg.
But Bastian, I think it's important to say that after the end of the First World War, it is, you know, Königsberg, as it then is at the heart of East Prussia, which is this enclave. It's separated, isn't it, from the rest of
Hold on,
Germany.
Jim. We should make the point, if people are looking for this on the map, on their Google Maps while we talk about it, they're not going to find Königsberg because it's Kaliningrad, in the Kaliningrad Oblast, which is, you know, in a reversal of what we're talking about, is now a Russian outpost outside Russia, you know, between, you know, next door to Poland. And it's sort of like it's a flipped situation, perhaps, now. Would you agree with that, Bastian?
Yes, it's now wedged between Lithuania and Poland. And, it's like tying into what James said and also what you say, Al, it is exactly, it's the exact opposite of what it was after the First World War, where you have like the famous Polish corridor that comes into being after Versailles. And this basically grants Poland access to the sea. But what does it mean? Everything east of it, which is East Prussia, is now cut off from the rest of Germany. So East Prussia is being cut off completely from Germany. Then in 1920, a revolt takes place in the city of Memel in the far north. That is then taken away. This is handed over to Lithuania. This becomes the city of Klaipeda. In the south, you have areas that have to be given over to Poland. So East Prussia becomes an embodiment of what the Germans call the bleeding frontier. Like, they are bleeding territory. And so you have this deep fear of everything that is considered to be Eastern or Slavic. There's such deeply ingrained fear. So this is not only this 700-year-old Teutonic history. No, this is also very acutely remembered. And even during the First World War, this is also something that we tend to forget a little bit, because we focus quite a lot on the Western Front, of course. Yeah. But East Prussia is the only province that is invaded by the Russians, of course. And no other German province, German area, sees fighting on its own soil. But the only place in Germany during the First World War where fighting takes place is in East Prussia. And this uproots also hundreds of thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of refugees. So if you're older than 40 years old, you remember this. You have experienced this in the Second World War. So if you are 40 in 1939, you are 15 by the time, basically, when the First World War starts, so give or take.
Yeah.
You remember this. You remember this acutely. It's not something of lore. It's not something of old days, something that your grandfather once told you. No, you were there. Like, you saw these refugees, and you were... you could have been part of it. So it is very acutely remembered.
Gosh, obviously that hadn't occurred to me, because our focus here is so firmly on the Western Front. And actually, you know, the war, and the it's a more fluid war, isn't it, on on the Eastern Front. Things, you know, armies come and go, basically, don't they, in a way that they just don't in the West.
Absolutely. And this is also why in the Second World War, there is this confidence that the German army will once again pull it off, because this is what happens in the First World War. You have Hindenburg, who is basically the star of the show there, together with Ludendorff, of course. Who basically, Hindenburg as a young man, like, it's hard to imagine Hindenburg as a young man, because we always know him as this mustachioed old Prussian, but you know,
yes, it looks like a wall. It looks like a walrus in our imagination. Yes, doesn't it? Yeah, basically.
But there was a day somewhere in the mid 1800s where he was in fact a young man, and when he was a young man, he was stationed in Königsberg, and he was especially interested in defending East Prussia. And what do you have in the east of East Prussia? You have the Masurian Lakes, these are called. So this is a lake district, and it is very uninhabitable. It's half swamp, it is half, you know, lakes. In the middle of that is like, it's Lützen, it's an important town, Rastenburg, which you of course know from Hitler's headquarters. So
yeah.
So this is a very important part to, and Hindenburg built his defenses and his defensive ideas around these lakes. And it is wildly successful. He basically, with a very small force, he defeats two Russian armies that basically come as a pincer. And he cuts them completely off. And it's incredibly successful. Once something very similar happens in 1944, a lot of these Prussians think, okay, you know, we know how this is going to go.
Yeah.
We will have to flee a little bit. And we will once again be victorious. And don't forget, of course, which I think a lot of people tend to really truly take into account, but the deep racism that helps explain this.
Yeah.
They actually think that the Soviets or the Red Army, they are just, you know, like, swamp people. They are Asiatic hordes. There's no leadership to them. They believe this much deeper, much stronger, with much more sincerity than they did in 1914. So a lot of people have no doubt that the war will end well. Of course, with the knowledge of hindsight and, you know, like being able to immerse yourself in sort of like strategic concerns taking place at Hitler's high command, you know, like, okay, this is absolutely not the case. But how can an average farmer in the east of East Prussia know this? He can't. This is what basically sparks a massive refugee crisis a few months later.
So it goes, so the pendulum swings, doesn't it, from thinking you'll easily defeat the Russians because they're subhuman, to being absolutely terrified of them because they're subhuman, who knows what savagery they will unleash, and also the component that people know perfectly well what they've been doing in the Soviet Union in terms of how brutally they've treated these subhuman. I mean, it's the way this sort of fire feeds itself is
absolutely.
It's really interesting, isn't it?
But the geography of Königsberg is that once you're pushed back to Königsberg, you've got nowhere else to go. It's a bit like kind of being at Dunkirk, apart from kind of evacuating, which of course lots of people did. But
well, one of the main differences between Königsberg and then Dunkirk, for example, is Königsberg does actually have a large hinterland. It's called like the Samland. It's a massive peninsula, lies beyond it. So obviously it's very hard.
But it is sort of on the sea, isn't it?
It is on the sea, but. It does then continue westwards a little bit, and you would have in a dream scenario, so to speak, you would have the opportunity to have agriculture there still while you're being besieged, which is exactly what happened. So people were just still tending the fields in the spring of 1945, being constantly strafed by the Soviets, of course.
So Königsberg ends up a festung.
Yeah, like a fortress.
A fortress city. The Germans are notable for doing this. They do it in Western Europe as well, with the various ports. What is the thinking behind these Festung cities? Because up to this point, the Germans have tried to be mobile in their prosecution of the war rather than get stuck. And this would appear to be, I mean, what's the... aside from heroic resistance in the face of the Asiatic hordes, you know, which I suppose would be a propagandistic way of looking at it. What's going on strategically here, or is anything happening strategically in the thinking? Is it to tie Russians up?
You're absolutely right that this is a very much misunderstood concept. Because, well, first of all, a lot of people think it's purely an extension of Hitler's propagandist boast, yeah. like fall where you stand, right? And I would concede that in the Soviet Union, which is where you first see these fortresses in March 1944, this is 100% the case. He cannot allocate any goods to it. There can be no security garrisons allocated, because every person that you need for a security garrison needs to be taken off the front line. There are no stocks that can be brought to it. Too many problems to solve. Now, what happens, and here we have to really understand the concept of total war, because this is where it becomes not only important, but where you see it in practice, is in 1945, or like better put, in the autumn of 1944, a string of German cities is now allocated as fortresses. And here the thinking of the German military command becomes very differently, because now they say, okay, our supply lines are shorter. We know in advance that they're coming, but here's the kicker. We can have our own civilians and second rank soldiers, Volkssturmmen, so like militia men. We can put those in these fortresses to defend them. These cities, for example, these German cities, and this is where the history comes in. They used to be already Prussian fortresses, so they have this ring of Prussian forts around them, sort of like of this big red brick fortresses, normally with overgrown at that point. These are as a ring around city, so it is not the city itself that you should see as a fortress within military thinking, but rather the city and its wider environment. So all these fortresses, they can offer artillery support to one another. That is how they have been set up already during the Prussian era. So they can basically offer support to each other. But this can be done with second rank unit. You don't need super units in a fort. These can be older men, which is what happens, or men with.
Because how hard can it be to kind of fire a fixed gun?
Yeah, exactly. And this is also the beauty. Where do all these guns come from, right? These are just old French guns that they have in stock since 1940. They have been kept in good nick during the war years, and they are just sit there. You can do absolutely nothing with them if you're heading into Russia in 1941, of course. But they are very, very useful in a fixed position. And that is what happens. So, like, here you solve two things. You solve the fact that you don't have oil at your disposal anymore, because that becomes obviously a very big thing. Like the Ploesti oil fields in Romania, they are under threat. All the synthetic oil just becomes harder. So you basically have to come up with a strategy that takes the maneuver out of your considerations to win. So how do you do this? You say, okay, fixed positions where we can actually rely on our own population, and then counterattack, because like that is of course the be all and end all of the final year of the war. It's like counter, like it's just a blanket thing that what is used quite often. But the beauty of a counterattack is that you don't need to have massive operations anymore. Like these can just be like much smaller in an effort. And what you sort of hope indeed in a with fortresses is that Russians run at it and just tire themselves out. That is sort of the hope, and that is very often that goes horribly wrong.
Königsberg is surrounded by completely, isn't it? It's cut off from totally and surrounded by the Red Army by end of January 1945.
Yes, it is.
And yet it does hold out pretty much till the end of the war, doesn't it?
Yeah. Königsberg is designated a fortress in late 1944. In January 1945, it goes under martial law. So this is where it becomes like a true fortress in the final sense of the word. But this means that stocks have been allocated to it well in advance. All the structures have been put in place already in November. That is all done. So it is not that the thinking still has to start by the time the Russians approach. So the fortress has been readied well in advance, and that is what marks the difference. There is 3 months of stock allocated to it. Food has been well taken care of. People in Königsberg actually say that they suffered no hunger as what happened in other parts of Germany in 1945. They basically all say, no, actually, we had our rations were pretty good, as long, of course, as you contribute to the defense of the city.
Right.
Because if you don't, then you're no longer eligible for rations.
So,
but as long as you contribute, you will have food.
Well, that was going to be my next question, because if what you're relying on is the civilian population and sort of second tier people, I assume it's the Nazi Party. How are the population of Königsberg and those second tier people being mobilized and motivated? Is there a difference because this is home soil? Because after all, we you know, very often we talk about the war in the West, the idea that there's a sort of change in tenor when, you know, and you mentioned Arnhem right at the start of this. Very often the thing people say about the Battle of Arnhem is, well, it's near Germany, so the Germans are fighting with a sort of newfound ferocity or a newfound seriousness because it's home soil almost. Is that part of the character of what's happening in Königsberg, or is that... is that not because if it's a Prussian fortress outpost anyway in its mentality, as a place and a culture, does it make any difference?
Yeah, I mean that's really an excellent question. Now it's what you see is that the propaganda actually changes in Königsberg during its siege,
right?
Because Berlin is very, very far away for people. Like, why would you care about what the nation thinks if you and your family is being shelled, right? So
yeah,
they look for heroes in their own past. So, for example, Immanuel Kant becomes important. Jörg von Wartenburg, like old Prussian soldiers with like ties really to Königsberg itself.
Yeah.
These are being elevated in propaganda. Hitler really disappears from the front pages in Königsberg. In this stage of the war, it is much less important. And what this, of course, means, because James, you said, is Königsberg completely encircled? The reality is, it is 90% encircled. There is still,
right.
They can leave on occasion through the like a canal. This is how some people get out of Königsberg in February.
Because it's this lagoon, isn't it? There's this lagoon, yeah, just sort of to the west of Königsberg. There's a river runs through it. I don't know what the name... what's the name of the river in Königsberg?
The Pregel.
And so that runs out of the city, then you get to the lagoon, and then there's a little sort of outlet that gets you out into the Baltic.
Yes, like it's called the Frisian Spit.
So, right.
So you have the Frisian Lagoon and the Frisian Spit.
And isn't it Operation Hannibal? Isn't that the name of the evacuation?
Well...
well, not really.
Yes and no.
Okay.
There's much has been made out of Operation Hannibal. And if you follow the sources, you actually will find that there is... I mean, like this is going to be quite controversial, I'd say. But there is no Operation Hannibal. There is a
lot... okay, because,
there are... which is not to say that there are a very large number of incredibly brave captains who go back and forth. But if you look at...
so lots of people are evacuated.
A lot of people are evacuated. But at the same time, more people evacuate themselves, as in they go over that spit from Königsberg to Danzig. And then either they stay there or move on. Then again, right. others who are evacuated by ship, they end up, for example, in Denmark or like in the north of Germany.
Yeah.
Or the bottom of the Baltic.
Yeah. So, yes, that is
like the Wilhelm Gustloff.
Yeah. These are the biggest ships, ship disasters or naval disasters ever. You have to imagine the Wilhelm Gustloff in size of lives lost. This is six times Titanic.
Yeah.
What goes lost there?
It's like 9,600 people.
Yeah.
I can't recall the precise number. It's huge.
It is a huge number. And the reality of it is we'll probably never know the real number because so many people just went on board without the accurate paperwork.
Yeah,
we have 6,000 people that we know for sure. Like they had paperwork. But then at that point, basically, the captain says, keep them coming. We have to take everyone we can out of there. And this happens multiple times that the ships are torpedoed. So not only the Gustloff, but you have like the Steuben and the Goya, which also have over 6,000 each.
Jesus.
Wow.
And these are insane numbers. But still keep in mind, this all amounts to less than 1% of all the people being evacuated. So obviously, we are very much drawn to these horrible, horrible losses, and they should absolutely be recognized as such. But by and large, most people who get on a boat actually do get to at least...
They do get away.
To a next stop, at least. I mean, a lot of them then still end up in Soviet hands because, you still... not everyone goes to Denmark. A lot of people just end up in Gotenhafen, which is today's Gdynia, so which is just near Danzig, Gdansk.
We need to take a quick break right now. We're talking to Bastian Willems.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. James and I are talking to Bastian Willems about Königsberg and the war on the Eastern Front.
So Bastian, you know, paint a picture. You know, I'm in Königsberg. It's, I don't know, it's the 28th of February 1945. You know, what's the city like? Is it already completely trashed? Are shells coming in all the time? How much bomb damage has been done by the RAF, etc., and by the Red Army Air Forces at this stage? Am I carrying in a cellar? What am I doing if I'm just an ordinary citizen?
Let's consider the average, say, 50-year-old man
Perfect.
At the at 28 February 1945. So shortly, like in the middle of February 1945, the Germans actually managed to break out from Königsberg to Pillau. And they managed to fight open a corridor. After the war, these commanders will claim, we did that to get civilians out. But you don't see any care being taken for these civilians at all, really. And they have, like as I said, they have to stay in the city to help with the defense. This includes women. This includes children. You have kids as young as 8 who are asked to use their sleds to hold grenades, to pass artillery coordinates. Women are ordered to report to Volkssturm units, obviously not to fight, but for example to mend socks, to fix uniforms. So every Volkssturm unit has a group of women attached to them that do this sort of work. Everything, of course, to free up every last man to the front. And of course, the men themselves, they are at the front. Now, if you are a 50-year-old man, this means that you grew up with a set of values that predates National Socialism, right?
Yeah.
So this means that you might not be as indoctrinated as these small Hitler Youth boys, for example, but you would either be in a Volkssturm unit or a fighting unit. Well, let's say you're in a Volkssturm unit. This means that you would be placed in the south of the city, where the front is basically has stabilized. So they take the German command. It takes out all useful units basically to free them up. So there's basically no tanks more. No tanks in the south of Königsberg. This is all being replaced by these men of poorer quality.
Yeah.
So that basically they can be seen walking around through the trenches. So if a Red Army commander is to look through his binoculars, he will see movement in the trenches. But obviously it's hard to see if this is a 50-year-old man or a 25-year-old hardened veteran from the Eastern Front. It always reminds me a little bit of, if you ever saw Home Alone, the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
You have this famous scene where Macaulay Culkin puts all these cutout images in front of his window to imply that there's a lot of activity in the house so that the intruders don't break into the house. And that is always what it reminds me of. It's just like it's not much more than a cutout, shapes basically. Because like these men are absolutely useless, and they know it, and the Soviets know it too at some point. Because obviously, Soviets go on very focused raids with the purpose of capturing soldiers. Like they organize as it happens everywhere, of course.
Yeah, aggressive patrolling. Yeah.
Yeah, so just take someone out, see, okay, what are the men of your unit? And that is, they just captured the 60-year-old. It's like, actually, everyone in my unit is born before 1900. He's absolutely tired. No one wants it. And the Soviets will produce leaflets and say, we know who you are. Why don't you just surrender?
Yeah.
Or put down your weapons, which is also what happens, of course.
At this, February 28th, 1945, do you have, people being executed for not pulling their weight?
Oh, my God, it's so many.
Yeah, exactly. Because it's famous that there's slightly later on, sort of April, there's a sort of wave of suicides. And people, I mean, in Berlin, famously, there's people running around hanging people and shooting people for not taking part. Is that going on in Königsberg at this point?
Absolutely, absolutely. And it always has to do with the proximity of the front. So the reason that this happens in Berlin in April is because the front is closed in April. In Königsberg, this happens from January. So like this predates all these all the orders that we have sort of like come to know. And you have like the famous order written by Tirac, like from mid-February. But the only thing that Tirac does here, like he's the minister of Reich Minister of Justice, is he formalizes something that is long taking place. Like by the time the German army retreats back onto German soil in mid-1944, it has already executed about 28,000 of its own. This is two full divisions that they basically put against the wall of their own.
Wow. 28,000.
God.
Yeah. And so in Königsberg, you see that this this goes even further. We have quite a lot of reports from people from Königsberg who attest that it is about 30 a day people being executed at the height. So throughout March, so 28 of February is basically, like that is like
a normal day.
The beginning of it, so to speak, sees from that point you have roughly 30 executions a day. And this is like, consider soldiers within the biggest inverted commas ever, because these the men being executed, they're not soldiers. These are a lot of old men, young boys who have been drafted into the military, have no time to acclimatize to military life. They've been told, now you are a soldier, as happens with a lot of militia, basically overnight. And this overnight is, we know this to be 28th of January, actually 1 month earlier. This is when the city becomes under martial law. No one really has been introduced to whatever martial law is. But what happens now is things that were considered to be very normal, they are now punishable with death. So you are a woman who has to take care of her family. You go into the house of your neighbor who you know fled westwards. 2 weeks ago, this was theft, punishable by, you know, a few weeks or months in prison, if you will, but still worth the risk. Under martial law, this is looting. It is punishable by death, and it happens. The same goes for men who change into civilian clothing. They are just scared men and nothing more, nothing less. And but obviously this is desertion, this is a Fahnenflucht, right? So like fleeing from the colors, and that is punishable with death. So this is what happens. So you have all these people who are mentally civilians, but because they are under martial law, everything changes for them.
They're under different rules and limitations. So who's answerable? Is this Koch who's answerable for this?
No. This is
because he survives the war, doesn't he?
This is also to my personal frustration. All these guys survived the war. It's always the
wow.
But I'd like to use this opportunity because already Al referred to it as well. We always go very hard on the party, right? The party man is the linchpin of late war violence, right?
Yeah.
But here you have a military that has been completely brutalized after 3 years of fighting on the Eastern Front. They have committed acts of genocide. They have evacuated hundreds of thousands of Soviets without any regard of their life. They have been killing their own, like as I said, in massive numbers for 3 years straight. These are the men. These hardened veterans, this core of very hardened veterans that are now put in places of seniority, these are now the men who call the shots. So these hardened veterans. So martial law, I'd like to stress, is military, right?
Yeah.
It is not a domestic law brutalizing. No, this is military law imposed on a domestic setting, right? So a lot of people are very eager to blame Koch, and he is. This man has many, many, many faults, and this should not be dismissed. But what is happening in East Prussia especially what
is the army. It's the army.
It's the army. Like, he takes very poor care of the evacuation of civilians. But even the Volkssturm, which is very often, again, like we see this as this party apparatus, especially in Eastern Germany, this is the army that basically incorporates them in its ranks. In the West, I would say it's a little bit different. There you see it is more the party. But in the East, they incorporate them in their units completely and use it as a manpower pool, if you will. So basically, by the time you have a good Volkssturm unit that is worthy its salt, they will be incorporated in a military division, basically.
But Bastian, from what you were saying earlier, you know, that this sort of, we're in East Prussia, which has this kind of, you know, very racist view of Slavic people and all that. Is it that this is fertile ground for this sort of brutality in a way that other parts of Germany aren't? Is East Prussia different in this respect to other parts of Germany? Or is this, as you say, a product of 3-4 years of fighting the Russians in an incredibly brutalized series of campaigns? Is it something to do with East Prussia, or is it not? Or I mean, obviously, that's either or is too strong. But what's the contributory factor?
Yeah, certainly it's not either or. This is a lot of things coming together.
Yeah, yeah.
So one of the reasons you already pointed to, it's the brutalizing army that comes back. And it is worth noting that the East Prussians, they don't need that Nazi narrative of racial hatred. To them, it's standard hatred. They already hated the Slavs long before East Prussia, before Hitler came to power, and had Hitler gone, and they would still be in place, they would hating them today. So this is just part of their culture, like for better or for worse.
Yeah.
And so this is not uncommon to them, which is also why they don't necessarily need all that that Nazified propaganda. Of course, Nazi propaganda takes this to a whole new level. But you can, your propaganda can, by its very nature, only be successful if you're building on something that is already held in the population. And in East Prussia, you don't need a lot of trouble convincing people that the Slavs are
no good.
Exactly.
Yeah. In fact, you've probably got them saying, at last someone who understands, at last someone in fancy old Berlin who finally understands how the world really works. I mean, is as likely a reaction. This is so interesting. And again, the Eastern Front operates on such a different, we've talked about the Eastern Front before, about how that the brutality of the fighting is actually the norm of the Second World War, and it's the Western Front that's the exception. In the Western Front, when you take your prisoners, you look after them, and all that sort of stuff. Do you think that that's a characterization that stands up?
Absolutely. Although the one thing that I think should be stressed when it comes to the Eastern Front, it's not one thing. Tend, as Western historians and as people broadly interested, to think the Eastern Front is one thing.
Yeah.
These are hundreds of different battlefields. Like the Eastern Front, there's 2,000 miles, I think, lie between Leningrad and Stalingrad, right?
Yeah.
600 miles between Brest and Moscow.
Yeah.
These are distances that we will struggle to understand. That it's too big, right? So we just say the Eastern Front as a umbrella term. I understand that, but this is for a regular soldier, this is not the reality. So you would have been part, for example, of the advance on Moscow or the advance on Leningrad.
Yeah.
And then the retreat back from these places. But this means that, like, you had nothing to do with what is happening in the Caucasus, so or something like that. So your war is your war, and it defines you in a very specific way. So if your unit just so happens to be very good in during retreat setting entire villages on fire, you're more likely to do that in the next village that you enter as well.
Yeah.
So you see, and this is also what happens when German troops moving back onto East Prussian soil, cutting down trees to make firewood, for example, which is what you tend to do normally. They just strip the houses where they are staying. So they are now stripping East Prussian houses. And this, everyone is absolutely outraged about this. Of course, within the grand scale of things and with now knowing like the things to come, this is all very minor. But you have report upon report saying, what is our military doing here on our own soil? They're stealing my rabbits. They are opening beehives to find honey, and all my bees died because I could have told them that it is winter. There are no bees, but now they're all dead. They are destroying my crops. They're taking my horse away. They slaughtered my pigs. Just everything that this army in retreat had been doing, they continue doing, because the enemy in front of them is the same. The way in which they operate, their unit structures remain the same. So there tends to be a very curious, at least I think, way in which we look at the fighting in Germany in 1945. It's almost completely detached from everything before and after.
Yeah.
But if you look at books on the Eastern Front, say, they all end in 1944. And then what happens to these soldiers? It seems that once they reemerge in the book on 1944, 1945, they're completely different men. It's like, no, yesterday you were in Lithuania, and today you fell back from Lithuania to East Prussia because, it's across the border.
Yeah.
You're the same person. Nothing has changed. And obviously, you're now on home soil. But this is only one of the factors that determines your behavior. There's so much more that, if you are from Bavaria, you might not give a hoot about East Prussia.
Yeah.
To you, it still looks very, East Prussia is very traditional looking. So to you, you go, it doesn't really look that different to Lithuania.
Well, and also you might not even know where you are. One of the things we've always talked about on this podcast is very often if you're an individual soldier, you've no idea where you are. You've no idea what that hill's called, or what the river behind you's called. You don't know. It's the idea that there's this sort of magical property that when you're fighting on German soil, suddenly everything's different.
But I am struck by this idea that by the end of the war, Königsberg is gone. It's in ruins. Its population's been, I don't know how many people were killed or left in those final months, but. It's gone, isn't it? It's basically kind of wiped from the earth. And Kaliningrad emerges out of it.
It is flattened. It's completely flattened to the point where this is so destroyed, we might as well just have completely a new street plan.
Start
so,
again completely. God.
Yeah, so very little remains the same.
Yeah, it's amazing. And do we know how many people were killed in the battle?
It is very hard. It's very hard to say. Obviously, I can give some estimates because it's not only the battle; it's also the period that follows. Because what you have is, we think that roughly 100,000 people were in Königsberg by the time the battle started, which is still a very large number. Again, due to the fact that not everyone was evacuated, but needed for the defense, right? So you have about 100,000 people in the city. So after 4 years, which is when Königsberg is completely closed off to Germans. Every German has to be taken out. Only 25,000 are taken out, basically. So we know that we lost 75,000 on the way. Now, not everyone dies to fighting. It's also, for example, malnutrition.
Disease because, and all those things.
Disease, you have outbreaks of malaria, for example, becomes very common in this area. typhoid, all these things. Of course, a lot of these Prussians are used as forced laborers themselves now in Russia. So this is also like tens of thousands of East Prussians that are taken eastwards. Some of them, of course, never return again. So it is very hard to say how many exactly died during the battle, but I would argue that's not even that relevant. I mean, in many cases, it might be better to be killed by the first grenade, so to speak, rather than suffering three years to it, and then first seeing your family die and then dying yourself. I mean, obviously, it sounds very cynical. I know that, but this is the reality. A lot of people for East Prussians, especially, the war only started in 1944 and ended in 1948. So May 1945 to them meant nothing.
Yeah.
To us in the West, that is the end of the war. So, yeah. What does this mean for my personal suffering? Nothing. In East Prussia, the suffering had really only just begun at that point.
Yeah.
And
But Bastian, you know, we're kind of running out of time, but you know, when you were doing this work on East Prussia and Königsberg, you know, where are you finding your sources for kind of, you know, eyewitness accounts and all the rest of it and the experience of what people went through?
Yeah, this is actually it was pretty hard to reconstruct the story of Königsberg, because there is no city archive. The city archive, of course, is destroyed, right? Where do all your sources end? A lot of corpse orders are destroyed. We are actually, interestingly enough, every so often, I would say every 3 years or so, a Russian treasure hunter digs up a suitcase full of corpse orders. A lot of of these guys seem to have buried them. That happens constantly. So so like every now and then, just something comes up, right? But for the rest, you'll find them in the archives in Berlin, in Freiburg. You'll have smaller museums in Lüneburg, in a town called Ellingen, Duisburg. But like the Yad Vashem in Jerusalem, in Kiel, of course. I'm forgetting in Kaliningrad itself, of course.
Right. And what's Kaliningrad like now? Obviously, there's some buildings that have survived. I mean, but is it a nice place to visit, or is it pretty rough?
Well, it is a very obviously with all that is happening in Ukraine, it's hard to say. But I'm still saying I love Russian people, and they not their leadership, but to me, Königsberg doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah,
you see very little of it. But if I am in Kaliningrad, I am always welcomed. I am the people there, they are long and old friends that I truly appreciate. And that is what makes, to me, Kaliningrad and the Kaliningrad Wider Oblast so interesting. It's more the smaller places. If you really want to see old Germany, I would suggest not going to Kaliningrad itself, but to the many coastal villages that surround it, because that is actually very beautiful and sort of like slow living vibe, if you will. Like these are all old like Kurorte, as they call them, like spas, spa towns, because you know, like it's all the fresh sea air, so to speak.
And you sit on the beach in a Strandkorb, don't you, one of those sort of sedan chairs. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, while massive battleships pass in front of you.
Yeah.
Because that's the interesting thing. Like, these are massive military ports. So we have quite some pictures where you see them in these wicker chairs and in these old 1920s, 30s wicker chairs. Which also have, like, have these little, like, Hitler flags next to them, like Jubelfahne, they would call them, and they just, like, they have them sort of like cordoning off where they're put down their towels, and then in the back you will see some battleships just passing through, because because the Germans considered up to 1940 the Baltic Sea basically their personal inland sea. Like, that is just basically their playing ground.
Yeah.
And with with Pilau, one of the most important ports, as was Danzig.
Well, Bastian, thanks so much for coming to talk to us.
I thoroughly enjoyed it.
It's just so fascinating. And again, I think your point about the Eastern Front, that there isn't one Eastern Front, that after all this, you know, that the front stretches across several countries, let alone armies and cultures. And also, I mean, a lot of this is old battles being refought too, not just of the First World War, you know, events that have come and gone in this part of the world for hundreds of years. I mean, it sits squarely in that sort of tradition, doesn't it? And
absolutely.
And the fact that there's a string of fortress towns in this Junkers colonized part of the world speaks of this ancient tradition of armies coming and going. I mean, people talk about Belgium being the cockpit of Europe, but you could argue that this is the cockpit of Europe in the other direction.
If Belgium is the cockpit, like, this is most definitely, to stay within the euphemism, like, this is maybe the motors of it all.
Yeah,
I think I thought that was a really point, very, very well made, I have to say. And as ever, it's in this vast subject, it's great to be kind of made to encourage to think about things in a different way. So thank you very much.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me.
Fantastic. Thanks for listening, everybody. We will see you soon. Goodbye.
Cheerio.